So we can now start taking questions if anyone has any.
Gautam, can you hear me?
Yes.
My question is regarding Kundalini awakening. Is it required for self-realization? Do we need to practice or something like that?
Kundalini awakening is one path. But anyone who is on the path of spiritual evolution, the Kundalini, which is nothing but the life force or the divine energy, is already being awakened. But if your inclination is to pursue the path of Kundalini yoga instead of, let's say, Jnana yoga, instead of Bhakti yoga, and so on, then by all means, you pursue that path. But as Ramana Maharshi said, as Ramakrishna has even said, even Ramakrishna had the experience of the Kundalini rising through the chakras. He didn't pursue it actively as a path of Kundalini, but it was part of the process of realization. So it all comes to the same, but you have to see what you are inclined to.
And I have posted one more question. And that question was related to relationships, how we handle in the real life, right? So sometimes what happens if you are a spiritual guy, so maybe others will take advantage of the situation and all. So you explain that that will come into picture. The problems will be there when there is a sense of doership. And if you remove the doership, there is no problem and there is no person at all. So is that understanding correct? So the moment the person thinks I'm not doing or there is no doership and doership vanishes, then definitely the problems will disappear.
The problems will not disappear. Your involvement in the problem and the mental anguish and angst which you were going through, which is psychological suffering, that is what will disappear.
So I in the same yeah in the same line, let's say somebody put a case, some property against some litigation case. So it is like, okay, I'm into spirituality, so I feel like everything is same, it's the one source. Not feeling, actually experience also. Let's say I have that trust. I literally agree to that point, whatever Maharaj said and Ramana Maharshi said, and even in day-to-day life I feel the same thing. But at the same time, if somebody does that, then as part of the life, we need to again fight with that case also, right, in the court. So it's not like,
Absolutely.
yeah.
Absolutely. But you see, this is something you have to decide. If it makes sense to go to court, by all means, you have to go to court because it makes sense. Now, I will give you my own case in point, which I've spoken about often. We had 15 years ago a general manager who ran away with a lot of our money. Now, our chartered accountant said you must file a case against him. Okay, now there were two points here. One was I knew that to file a case means that I had to be prepared for a long battle in court. And two, my nature was not to fight such battles. And three, I understood that this was meant to happen, and now I had to decide that do I move on in life or do I fight this battle and try and get him to give me back the money and so on and so forth. And my conclusion was that I don't have it in me to do this, so I did not file a case against him. But someone else may feel that no, I have no option but to file a case because that's my only means to get my money. I don't have enough reserves. Then common sense must prevail. What has happened is that your focus has shifted from blaming the other and hating and condemning him because now you know that this happened because it was meant to happen. If it was not meant to happen, it would not have happened. So all that dialogue of the thinking mind, which is invested in blame, doership, hatred, malice, and all that, is finished. So the thinking mind is now a blank slate. And with that blank slate, decisions are taken. Practical, pragmatic steps are taken. Do I go ahead with filing a case? Don't I file a case? And then life takes its course. That is the gift of the teacher.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Gautam?
Yes?
Can you hear me?
I can. Vandana.
Okay. Yes, I just want to ask you, when does the awareness that the newborn is born, when do you say the newborn is aware and becomes a doer?
Sorry, I didn't hear you, Vandana. When a newborn is born?
When does he or she become aware and becomes a doer?
Yes. You see, a point comes in that newborn's life. Earlier when it cried, the mother came running to it to give the mother's milk. Then a point comes when it realizes that if I cry, my mother will come running to me. That is when the ego with its sense of doership gets born, which usually happens between the age of 1 and 2. When what was pure awareness, pure being, crying was arising naturally without any person invested there, what happens is now this thing happens in the consciousness that now observation has happened that if I do this, my mother comes running. And slowly this ego starts taking birth. The ego is not present at the time of birth. The tendencies are present. The sanskaras and vasanas are present. But in this birth, this is how the sense of doership gets born. And then slowly everything works that way. That is why we find that when children are growing up, they become obstinate, stubborn. They'll put their fingers in plug sockets just to tease you, to see your reaction. Why? Because it's something I am doing. If I put my finger in that socket, I elicit a response. So that is the birth of doership.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hi, hello. Gopi.
Who's this? I can't see your name.
Hello, Gautam. Can you hear me? Aki here.
Yes. Okay.
Can you see me, Gautam?
Yes, I can.
Yeah, perfect. Gautam, off late, I have been following Ramana Maharshi's books and principles a lot. And one of the major significant points which Ramana Maharshi says in one of his talks with his disciples is when one of the disciples asks him, is everything in life predetermined and predestined? I mean, we can believe or understand that the most significant things or actions which happen in our life are predestined. But how about small, insignificant actions like going and drinking a glass of water? Are those things also predetermined and predestined? Ramana Maharshi says, yes, everything is predestined. And the main purpose why we take birth is to experience and perform all these actions as per the prarabdha karma. So this teaching, we see other spiritual people who, in a sense, contradict that because they say you are the maker of your destiny. You can change your destiny. They talk about law of attractions and so on. So this is somewhat contradicting and confusing. So if you could please throw more light on that, that would be really great.
You see, you have to go with the teaching which appeals to you intuitively. Now, for example, let's say you feel like drinking a glass of water. Who put the thirst in your mouth in the first place? So if that was not happening, you would not have wanted to have a glass of water. So therefore, the action of having the glass of water, was it your action? No. An event happened prior to that on the basis of which this thought came that I am thirsty and I want to have a glass of water. That is why a very common example used in Ramana Maharshi's satsangs was when he said there is no free will and someone from the audience put up their hands and said, me putting up my hand means it is my free will. And Ramana said, absolutely not, because if I had not said there is no such thing as free will, you would not have put up your hand. You see? Now the whole point is, you have to decide that does the law of attraction give you peace or does Ramana Maharshi's teaching give you peace? I always come back to this. What is your measure? Now, your measure might be, I want worldly things in life. I want material gains, so to speak. And therefore, I agree with what the law of attraction is saying. And I would like to follow that by all means. Because being on the path of Advaita doesn't mean looking down on any teaching as such. But this is a call which you have to take. The problem with, not problem, I would say, the trap we fall into with being the masters of our destiny and so on is, it can lead to a lot of attachment to material things and objects. And as we know, our journey is a journey of loss, ultimately. Our journey is a journey of letting go, of giving up. So it all depends where you are on your journey of life. And if you feel that Ramana's teaching has actually appealed to you because that is your life's experience, then my suggestion, not my advice, my suggestion is to follow that.
Sure, go.
You see, I would like to add here that concepts like the law of attraction have actually come from the same source. When we look at our Mahavakyas, see, the law of attraction refers to affirmations. You know, you already affirm what you want, let's say. Now, Nisargadatta Maharaj saying, I am that, aham brahmasmi, tatvam asi, these are affirmations. But what they have done is, they have taken the person out of the limited entity of a body and this shell and placed the consciousness in its primal position. That is why Maharaj would say that when people come to my satsang, I'm not talking to individuals. It is consciousness talking to consciousness. That is also an affirmation. That's a beautiful affirmation. There was a course which I had done based on Tibetan breathing exercises. They had an affirmation which said, the riddle of the universe is about me and I am now solving it. It was extremely interesting because it was showing that there is a me and there is some awareness that there is a me. So this can be an endless topic of discussion, which in fact I would love to go into maybe as a separate talk, because there are a lot of benefits of the law of attraction, not in the sense as it is commonly known as, but the actual law of attraction, the law of vibration. We all vibratory fields. We all are emitting a vibration. And in that sense, like attracts like. That is the law of attraction. So I would love to delve into all these aspects because we can gain tremendous insights from it, but perhaps a separate talk just on this would be right, so we can allow others to ask questions.
Sure, thank you.
But I can almost guarantee you that if you follow Bhagwan Ramana's teachings, you're in safe hands.
Yeah.
Hello.
Hello. Yes.
Can you hear me, sir?
Yes, I can.
Okay, so my question is about my experience on this path of spirituality. I would now not say that I am progressing on this path, but what I experience is, though I'm very much functional with all the roles in my life as a daughter, as a mother, as a sister, as a teacher, I'm experiencing that I have become equidistant, or rather I would say, I would use the word moderation, and all the transitory emotions are now moderated. So is it a phase? I would love to call it as a phase because it's a path, so it's a continuous process. So does a certain phase come in one's life where everything is moderated, and as Eckhart says, you start witnessing everything from a distance, and so everything is neutralized and stabilized?
So in that sense, it is not a phase. In that sense, it is the new way of being and looking at life. Phases are those which come and go. So if there has been a transformation in the way relationships are viewed, looked at, and the sense now which arises, which is, let's say, a sense of calm, equanimity, distance, so to speak, or witnessing, let's use that word, that means that to that degree that transformation has happened. And that is the new way of looking at relationships. So it is not a phase, it is a milestone. When you are on the journey, you are on the journey home. And there are signs which are provided. And the biggest sign is your attitude to life. What happens? How do you react in situations? If you feel there is a change in that compared to what you were 3 years ago or 5 years ago, these are indicators of life's journey. Because usually when we are reacting, it is an automatic reaction based on genetics and conditioning, and it's always action-reaction between two individuals. When that dynamic changes, when you no longer see yourself reacting to that degree, or rather you are now responding, then you understand that what has happened is witnessing has started setting in. Being in the present has started setting in. So the old scripts, the old grooves of conditioning are no longer playing out. You're no longer going into those loops and cycles like you used to earlier, as a result of which one is not that involved in the drama of relationships.
Right. So as we call in Bharatanatyam, there are transitory emotions and there is a sthayi emotion. So the sthayi emotion is of peace, and all the transitory emotions are like vanishing gradually. That's what I feel.
That's great, because it could happen for many on the path that they are going through what my teacher would call a flip-flop. Sometimes they are at peace in the relationship. Sometimes it is back to the old dramas and role-playing, etc. But the fact that at least one side is being experienced, whereas earlier it was always this whole chaotic tennis match going on, that is the flip-flop. Now that flip-flop also will not continue for the rest of one's life as a flip-flop. Gradually, the sense of peace, the flip and not the flop, will start dominating, because that has already happened. The new conditioning has already kicked in, and that will take its course.
Right, sir. Thank you.
Hi, Gautam.
You know, my teacher used to quote a Russian ballet dancer called Nijinsky. And he would always mention one of Nijinsky's quotations, which he loved, which was, Nijinsky dances best when Nijinsky is not there. Which means there is no Nijinsky thinking, he is doing the dancing. Okay, next question.
Hi, Gautam. Meenakshi here. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi. This is regarding the meditation. So in the last few sessions, we spoke about witnessing. And so during meditation, when the witnessing is happening, I realize there is witnessing and the process. There is a witnesser and there are objects that are being witnessed. So there is still duality in this entire process. So how do we come to an understanding of absolute non-duality?
Who is the one who realizes that there is a witnesser and witnessing happening?
the witnesser is the one who realizes the entire scheme of things, and that is after the meditation, when he comes back out of the entire process, when he analyzes. So that's when the witnesser knows.
No, so that is the ego. The ego is the one which claims that it was the witnesser in the meditation. Because the ego then refers to the meditation as an experience it had. The sheer fact that after the meditation got over, you said it is only after that you realizing all this, it is the ego with its sense of doership which has stepped in. Now let's take something very simple. During the meditation, where you are just being, and you are being to the degree that the first thought comes up. Let's say something about what a friend said, or let's say something at work. Mm-hmm. Now that background of being and the thought coming is actually one process. What happens is that after the meditation, the ego steps in and says that while I was meditating, 2 minutes after the meditation, this thought came up of my friend. That is the ego. You see? Okay. So, witnessing can only happen when there is something to witness. In meditation, if one is aware, let's say even if I've sat for 5 minutes of meditation, and I am aware that those 5 minutes were very difficult for me because I had 100 different thoughts. Who is the one who knew that there were 100 different thoughts? In the meditation, was that one there? Or is it after those 5 minutes that you look back and you say, oh my God, I had so many thoughts in my meditation? Because yes, in the meditation, there's no judgment whether there's one thought or 100 thoughts. The screen of consciousness is what witnessing is. It's a screen. Now the screen, as is the cliche in talks on Advaita, does not care whether a violent movie is being shown, a comedy is being shown, a romance is being shown. The screen is the screen. It is not concerned with the contents of what appear on the screen. And therefore, what happens in life is the screen of witnessing, of being. It is the screen which starts coming more and more into the foreground of one's daily living. Because you know that everything else which plays up on the screen is transient, temporary. Scenes are changing, fleeting by, creating a kind of story, but one is grounded in being.
So the screen is the non-dual, non-Advaita, so to say. Is that correct?
The screen is what is. The screen is what is. Without your sense of being, nothing would be happening, right? Everything is happening because you are. In that field of awareness of you are, everything is happening.
So but then there is everything, and then there is awareness. So isn't there still a duality in that? I mean, in my everyday life, how do I bring out a total universal consciousness, a total non-duality, that everything is me, that understanding?
All the talks are about non-doership itself. All the videos, the entire teaching is the foundation of that. Because after all, you are operating in the manifest realm. This is the realm of duality. This is the realm of polaric opposites of duality. Love and hate, up and down, black and white, rich and poor, front and back, pleasure and pain. This is the realm of duality, but what has happened is that we have converted the mechanics of duality into dualism, and the me and the other, which are the polaric opposites in duality, has become me versus the other. The only way out of everything is then one goes into samadhi and sits, but that is not what life is about. And therefore, the measure is peace of mind.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, Gautam.
Yes, Mahantesh.
Yeah, this word like beingness is used too frequently.
I can't hear you at all. I mean, it's very faint.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Can you hear me now?
Yes, yes.
Okay. The word beingness is very frequently used in I Am That book also. So I asked the same question in the last meeting also. Beingness is like the state where the memory erased, the memory of what I am, the identity basically that I carry, the name and the form. If that is erased, then whatever remains, that pure awareness, that is beingness.
That is a way to explain it, but even a sage will respond to his name being called. If you called Ramana Maharshi when you were at his ashram and he'll turn around and look, surely, because his name is being called. It's not that everything is being erased. That is the way to explain it.
Okay. No, I'm talking about when we sit for meditation, we need to feel that beingness, right? So when we sit for meditation, we need to feel that pure awareness. So I'm talking about when we are in that meditative state, when we are doing the meditation. So the often referred as we should be in the beingness state, right? I amness and beingness. So yes, that is nothing but removing the identity of personal identity. And once we remove the personal identity, slowly the thoughts will stop appearing.
Yes, it is not removing the personal identity. See, and it is also not about getting to the beingness state. Beingness is what is there. Everything has got layered on it, you see. So what happens with meditation is that the awareness of that being, the primordial being, one is getting more and more established in consciousness, you see. Because as Maharaj said, that we have been too involved in doing things and in using consciousness. But in meditation, consciousness is contemplating on itself. What does that mean? It is just staying put in being, not in doing. And in that staying put in being, what happens is all the mundane thoughts of life and living, the more and more one is put in being, those are witnessed. And then the grasp which the thought has on the thinking mind, that starts collapsing because one is more resting in being. It is an automatic process. So you don't have to also do anything to rest in being because that is already what you are. The gift of meditation is because we are so busy during the day, when we sit back, this all has a chance to be witnessed. And so that resting in the being becomes more and more a natural state going forward, because till now we were too consumed in doing.
Okay, thank you.
Are there any more questions for today?
Yes, namaste Gautam.
Namaste.
Indra speaking. So the question is, when Krishna says in Gita that endless peace comes only through renunciation, is he also talking about renouncing the doership?
Absolutely.
So I still didn't really get into this doership thing quite well, because I, as long as I'm a body, I have the ego, right? So when I have the ego and when I'm doing certain things, how do I not tell myself that I'm not doing it? Or it is happening. I quite don't understand that.
You don't have an ego. You are the ego. You are the ego. And this whole question of doership is what is precisely the Gita is all about that. Now, just very quickly to go into it, because it's there in all my talks and books. It is in the Gita, the same example is when Arjuna refuses to fight and he tells Krishna, I am not going to fight. I can fight my family, but my preceptors, I will not raise my bow and arrow against them. And I refuse to fight. And he puts his bow and arrow down. And Krishna tells Arjuna, look here, you have been trained to be a warrior all your life. Your entire conditioning, your genetics are that of a warrior. So why do you think you are doing something? You have to pick up that bow and arrow and fight because it is your nature. And as time, I, Krishna, have already killed them. But you are the instrument through whom the action will happen. So this becomes a way of living. When you do know in your own life that whatever you do, whatever you decide to do is based on your genetics and your conditioning over which you had no control, what happens is guilt and shame or hatred for yourself drop away because you know that you could not have done things any other way. That is the meaning of living with this sense of non-doership. It doesn't mean you will sit home and do nothing. You will do what is in your nature to do, knowing that truly you are not the doer. It is God who is the primal doer. Because God has gifted you with these attributes, just like God has gifted others with their attributes.
So this understanding has to sink in, because if I tell myself constantly that you are not the doer, that is also a type of conditioning, right? And that thought vanishes.
Absolutely, you're absolutely right. But look at your own life's experience. Look at your own nature and ask yourself, did you create your nature or was it circumstances in your environment, in your growing up years, in the economic background of your family, which shaped your thought processes in a certain way? Ask yourself these questions, introspect on that, and you will come to the conclusion that whatever I think and say and do is based on so many factors which were not in my control.
Another question is, often what we feel within us is not equated exactly to what we do. And then when our actions don't really depict what we are actually thinking inside, the action tends to look wrong, like appear wrong to others. But you can never explain what you actually mean with doing any action. How do you reconcile this?
You have answered your own question, because if it was in your power, that would not have happened. That's the whole point. We feel one thing and we do something else. That is the human nature. That is the extent of control we have.
And there's a conflict within that, and because of that, I think we again suffer.
Exactly. Exactly.
And other things are like, often sometimes when you think about something, you need a answer for a question and that just pops out. Like when you read a book, or when even today in the session, I had a lot of questions which others have asked you and I got the answers like that. So often
that is
it
happens. The beauty of satsang. That is the beauty of satsang.
So does that mean that we are all connected and there is only one consciousness and everybody knows what's happening within each other's mind?
It doesn't mean, except that whatever is meant to happen will happen as long as we are open and receptive to it. And even that is not in our control.
Kind of fatalism, I feel now. Nothing is in our control.
You see, that is the ego's first objection to the teaching, because shit scared. But when you tell the ego, my friend, your next breath is not in your control. The blood coursing through your veins is not in your control. The sheer fact that you are sitting down is thanks to the laws of gravity, which is not in your control. The sheer fact that you are made up of 70% water and therefore directly influenced by the moon, which does enormous things to the tides, like the high tide and low tide, and therefore has an influence on your emotions, means that the emotions are not in your control. Now, when you are presented so much with what is not in your control, do tell me what is in your control.
Yes, but so, why are we even...
Exactly.
Are we even given a mind and a body and this life?
The ego feels helpless. The ego feels shocked that the world does not depend on me. I am not the center of the universe. And it feels this teaching is fatalistic. But deep down, this teaching frees one up from this baggage of doership and all the associated emotions one has been carrying with it. Deep down, it knows that. But the ego considers itself extremely precious, a precious commodity which cannot bear the thought of its absence and its annihilation. And that is why it says this is a fatalistic teaching. I might as well sit home and do nothing. Try. Is it in your nature to sit home and do nothing? Try.
You can't even do that.
Exactly. So the important point here is that when one feels this sense of fatalism arising, one understands that it is a defense of the ego to raise this objection. Because the ego is now threatened that what will I be powerful if my sense of doership is taken away from me? So the ego wants to reassert itself. So now it says, oh no, this teaching is fatalistic because the ego does not want to die. But the good news is that it's too late, because the sheer fact that you are listening to these teachings means that, as Maharaj would say, the seed has already been planted.
I hope it's for the good. Thank you.
Yeah.
Gautam sir, may I have one quick question, please? Hello?
Yes.
Gautam sir, may I have one quick question, please?
Yes.
During my meditation session, sometimes I'm experiencing something. Usually, like mostly it happens with me that there's this narrator coming up as soon as I start to experience something, and it starts to speak exactly my experience as if I'm telling it to somebody. Not anybody in particular, but it's just narrating the whole experience and killing it actually for me. Is that the ego?
Yes, that is the voice in the head.
The moment I start experiencing it, pops its head right away. And it's just so irritating and it doesn't stop. And
who is aware of it? Who is aware of this?
That's a start, I know, to be aware. But how does it stop? When does it stop?
It will stop when it is meant to stop.
Everything comes to non-doership ultimately.
Everything to acceptance, and acceptance leads to witnessing. Then one is no longer invested in the outcome or in wanting things a certain way. Because whenever you find that you want a specific outcome, that is the ego which has walked in through the back door. So the sheer fact that one is aware of the voice in one's head is actually a beautiful gift. Why not just accept that gift and see where it leads on its own without trying to control, I like it, I don't like it, where will it go, where will it take me? I'm getting fed up. I'm getting frustrated.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, Jayant. I see you there. I can't hear Jayant. Can someone? Jayant, are you saying something? I can see you.
But I...
I think Jayant was asking a silent question.
Hi, Gautam.
Hello.
Can you see me, Gautam?
Yes.
This is Sai from Bangalore, Gautam.
Hello.
Good morning. I have been going through Eckhart's book, The Power of Now. I think I talked about it last week as well. And he talks a lot about the unmanifested way of God being there. He takes an example of a room being there and people speak about the furniture in it, the fans, the equipment and so on, but not the space that actually pervades the room itself. And he says that the space is so important in the context of the room, but we don't really perceive it in the right possible way. So is the space really the unmanifested being that we speak about normally? And how do we really comprehend the space consciousness? He says, you know, the entire galaxy is full of space, but the objects in the galaxies are sort of there as atoms in the scheme of things. To comprehend that space consciousness and the space itself is something that I'm finding a bit difficult to, you know, sort of get to have a feel of it. What is it really, you know, speaking about there in terms of the space?
So in manifestation, that space is the being. That space is the being. Now, Siddha Rameshwar Maharaj, who was Nisargadatta Maharaj's guru, gave a very good example that supposing you see something, let's say there's a painting on your wall, there's a clock or something. Obviously, between you and that clock, there's space. But your eyes are falling on the clock, on the object, because space is not seen as an object. Now, what is that space in the manifest world is being. In beingness, the object of a clock has arisen on the wall. So this becomes very real. It is no longer a theoretical concept of what is the unmanifest, how to bring the unmanifest down to daily living, because it is all already here. But in manifestation, what is happening is when the focus is not on objects, what is the focus on? On being. And so when we come back to what we spoke about, you are not what happens, but you are the space in which things happen. That space in that sense represents the unmanifest in the manifest world. So that space is the space between two thoughts, let's say. That space is the space between two happenings in your life. That space is the space between pleasure and pain. Everything is happening in that space, which is the sense of presence, which is the being in which this whole Leela is arising. So for us, that is sufficient and adequate, that whenever something is experienced or encountered in life, the awareness that it has arisen on the screen of consciousness, on the screen of presence, so to speak, it is witnessed. And what course it takes is also witnessed. So it could be an event in your life. It could be a certain thought pattern. It could be a relationship. What will happen is witnessing will start happening. If you take a specific relationship which was troubling you, someone you didn't get along with, let's say a family member who pushed your buttons or a friend who always tends to antagonize you, till now, one has been consumed in that story. The space is when you accept that he is precisely the way he has been made. just like I am precisely the way I have been made. When that sense of doership is pulled out from this equation of two individuals, what is happening? Space is being created. You are allowing him to be the way he is, not the way you want him to be. You are allowing him to say the things he says because that's the way he has been designed, just as you have. That, in a theoretical sense, becomes living in the unmanifest, because now you are just the space in which things happen. And then that becomes the way of living. It becomes a way of allowing, it becomes a way of seeing, and it becomes very real, because when that happens, one is more and more established in being. And to be established in being is to be established in peace.
Thanks, Gautam. Different dimension, different way of, you know, doing things, but thanks for the clarification.
Yes. So I think that would be sufficient for today. And I would once again like to say that these times of the lockdown are in fact precious gifts to introspect and not get consumed by fear or by, you know, what's happening outside, etc., but spend time to look at the journey within, because that will take you very far beyond the lockdown to the end of the lifespan that has been allocated. And the result will be peace and equanimity.